Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, listeners. You have just turned into the Dynamic Dojo on October 27th, 2013. I am really excited about this show. Our guest tonight, his segment will start about 6:30, is Master Ed Parker Jr. And I've been trying to get Master Parker on the show since it began. Actually, I was asking him to be our first guest, but his schedule kept conflicting. I'm glad to have him on here tonight. A couple things before we start the show. If you're expecting to hear Sifu Rusty's voice, sorry to be so disappointed. She's in the Philippines at the present time, but may call in later. I understand she's going to. Our network has taken on a different flavor. We've added some shows to the network. One is The Legacy Forum with Harry and Robin Shivery. That'll be Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific time, 7 p.m. Eastern. I think we're still working on the time frame for that show. We have Violet Reiki Radio with Rose Jimenez Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We have The Bucket List with April Vidal Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. And we do have more shows coming that are in the works. Listen, we're trying to put together a seminar circuit for Sifu Rustita. She is absolutely the number one worst person on promoting herself, but that's what I'm here for. If anybody in the Seattle area or abroad would like to have full whip seminars, stick seminars from Dose Pares, Qigong, Tai Chi, you name it, if it's within her realm, she'd be glad to come out and do a seminar for you. And with that said, Sifu Rusty this February is getting inducted into the Association of Women Martial Arts Instructors Hall of Fame. She will also be teaching there. Congratulations, Rusty. I am really, really proud of you. Now, a couple weeks ago, we did a show live from PAMA, the Pacific Association of Women Martial Arts Instructors. Well, Rusty had let me know that she was actually elected to the executive board as well. Now, with Sifu, she has a lot on her plate right now. when she says, "I'll call you back shortly," don't buy it. She's not going to call you back for a long time. I catch that all the time. Now, Elaine Yamano is having a tournament coming up, November 2nd. I'm sorry, on Facebook I said November 22nd. Elaine, I apologize. It's November 2nd, next weekend at Yamano Shorin Ryu Karate Studio at 5370 Schaefer Avenue, Suite E, in Chino's. In Chino's. Those are the type of pants people wore in the 50s. In Chino, California. This fall tournament is a fun and friendly event. Do you have what it takes to be a winner? Of course you do. Everybody does. All who enters will receive an award. Only $20 entry fee if paid by 10/26. That has passed. There will be a $27 entry fee anytime after that date. You may choose one or two events, kata or kumite, for the same price. Must have protective gear to spar. Hope to see you there. 9 a.m. Peewees, white through purple belts, kids, or 10th, 9th, and 8th Q beginners. 11:30 a.m. green, white, black belts, kids and adults. 7th and up to first Q of black belt adults, all ranks are this time as well. For more information or to register for, you may contact your sensei dojo or email YSRK 7757 at gmail.com. She's always having tournaments. Everybody always has a fun time there. Now, Rusty was supposed to be joining us, and she's listening right now, but she is in the Philippines, and they're having a little intermittent Wi-Fi thing going. And, of course, if you listen to the show for any length of time, you know that every once in a while we have technical difficulties. Until I started doing some shows of my own when Rusty couldn't make it, all I had to do was blame all my technical difficulties on her. And right now I can't do that. So we are going to go into one of Rusty's segments that she usually does. We're going to do health news, which is unusual for me to do it. Oh, and we have a caller. We might end it right here. We've got Master Ed Parker Jr. calling in. Master Parker, how are you?
Actually, I'm excellent. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, sir. I'm doing well. How was the seminar this weekend?
It was actually an eye-opening experience. It was an event that was hosted by the American Veterans Association, and it was more a movement for veterans to push for peace, and they wanted me to go up there and represent a peaceful direction because of the direction I'm going in personally, and it was just a great trip.
Oh, excellent. Are you still on your way back? So I know you told me you were going to be driving back about this time.
Unfortunately, I'm an obsessed guy, and if I have it in my head to come home, I just come home. And it was a 24-hour trip. It was 8 hours up, 8 hours back, and everything in between was just the event. So,
Wow. You know, they called James Brown the hardest working man in show business. I think you're one of the hardest working men in martial arts.
I think rest is for the dead.
Very nice. You know, I've asked you before to be on the show, but our schedules have always conflicted. Thank you so much for being on today.
My pleasure.
My host is a little upset because you're on and she's in the Philippines enjoying herself, and she can't make it today, and she's having technical difficulties. Why don't we start by learning about your history? A lot of us know a little bit about it, but we don't know your full martial arts history.
Of course not. They're too busy focused on my dad.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's right.
And rightfully so, because he was the one who earned that right. People's attention on me wasn't necessarily one that I wanted in terms of my martial journey. My martial journey was completely different than what people needed, because they needed to be satisfied with what they thought a journey should be. And I could care less. My journey was my journey, and how I did it was, it was just the way life was. And the reason why I'm saying that is because 90% of my training was never in a studio.
Hey, so, understand.
I was the Karate Kid. I was, my life was around Mr. Miyagi. And so it wasn't a karate studio moment for me. And a lot of it is because at the beginning my dad was shielding me from that industry. Part of it is because of his religious beliefs. Part of it was because of my mother. Part of it was just because of the evolution of where things were. Part of it was because he noticed it wasn't my interest when I was young. We had a conflict of interest in the way that we were raised when I was young. And that my dad saw other martial arts raise their children where they forced the children to do martial arts. And he saw that happen. He started to go in that direction at the beginning, and then all of a sudden he just kind of dawned on him that he's like, this isn't right. So you know what? I'm going to allow my kids to manifest the talents that they show. I'll see what I can do to support that instead. I think that was his intended goal, but it wound up just being how he tolerated what everybody else did instead of supported. Because, he was a man who was an obsessed man about his goals and about making a difference on the planet and everything else. So you can't do that without a support team. So, you depend on people. And even though they have other interests, it doesn't mean that they don't need their help. And that's the way my dad was. He needed my help. A good chunk of the reason why his system is the way it is because of the backbone of his support team, and the leader of that was me. So,
wow. Now, I noticed from your bio, you went a totally different direction at times.
Because it was interesting because somebody was asking me, you know, how much, you know, why am I not like my dad? And I'm like, you know, that's kind of a stupid question in general. It's like identical twins are only alike in looks. You know what I mean? Everybody
right.
has a different personality. Everybody does has a different interest. And everybody has a different interest based upon their upbringing, too. I wasn't raised in a Honolulu ghetto. I was raised in a mansion by a wealthy martial arts successor. Yeah, I mean, a successful martial artist. My father, you know, he wasn't extremely wealthy, but considering, you know, where he was in life and where he went, it was amazing, his story. And it's just I had a different life, and my diversities were quite different than what he did. But it's weird, though, because some of that my interests were totally influenced by my family, but not necessarily my immediate family, meaning my dad's brother was a professional artist, and he was my first art hero. And so, you know, it's like you go to family things and you spend time with the uncles that are most loving to you, and that's who influences you, you know?
So, oh, wow. Okay, sure.
So that's kind of where the art direction went to. But my art career started from when I was in kindergarten, and I was drawing like every other kid was drawing, and it was Snoopy was the influence at the time. And so everybody was drawing Sopwith camels, which is a biplane in the British Army of World War I. And it's an easy thing to draw because all it is basically an elongated kind of triangular shape. And you just draw, you know, a couple of brief lines for the airplane, and it never was meant to be a dimensional thing. It was only a two-dimensional drawing, and the kids in my kindergarten class would draw it and stuff like that. And I was the first kid to draw a crash plane where the plane was cracked in half, and I really liked the attention I got from people thinking that I had a creative mind, that I went beyond what other people did, and I think that's where it started, where it's just you just like pushing the boundaries of creativity, and that's where I went with artwork. But I realized that artwork isn't only subjected to pen and paper. Artwork is also movement. And what happened is one day I combined my martial arts training and my artistic training, and that's what I am today, the culmination of all of that. In fact, my Paschal Art System, which is talked about briefly here and there, that's how it was discovered, was the merging of my martial training, the merging of my more of a quest to just be done with this fantasy that martial artists go through, which is constantly every time you train with a partner, they're the faux bad guy. Every time. Every single time we train, the guy in front of us is a faux bad guy. And we never, ever, ever practice where our scenario is a win-win. It's always how we're going to cover the most deadly circumstances. Then after my dad died, I heard his movement and his following say, wow, we're going to follow Ed Parker's path, and we're going to make Kempo more deadly. Now, to me, I think that's the biggest joke on the planet is how many more shades of death can you get? Dead is dead. How can you make more deadlier? So, and I'm not saying that to discredit his lineage. I'm just saying that to discredit the thought process. You know, it's just a ridiculous thought process to make things more deadly and to take it further than it really needed to go. But that's actually what MMA was. MMA was the continuation of that thought process that the Kempo community had, which was how can you make things more deadly? And so instead of finding that deadliness within just one art, what the culture did was said, let's take a buffet of the best deadlies of every art and put them together. The problem with the buffet line is they forgot to pick any of the main course. They only pick desserts. They only pick the pie. They only pick the cake. They only pick the pudding. They only pick the ice cream. They never pick the vegetables. They never pick anything that was healthy. They picked the most unhealthy of the stuff. They put it together, and they threw it out there. But the problem with that is there's no venue for it. So what they did is they put it in a ring. And they still had to kind of put down some kind of barriers on the topic, you know, because death isn't, you know, cool. You know,
right.
Bad thing has death. So what we do is we take it to the edge and we make it a sport. You know what? It has a category. It's a sport. We don't kill people. And you know what? Newsflash, we shouldn't be in wars now. At least the U.S. shouldn't be in wars. Okay, we're top dog. It's over. There should be no reason why we send any of our military to death again. We're the top dogs on the planet right now. Why are we throwing our humans at other cultures and putting them, you know, it's time to kind of change the mental thought process. You know, I think we've been a warrior culture for 200,000 years, and it's not going to change overnight, but you have to start somewhere. And the direction I'm going in my life is to replant the seeds in our grandchildren. Right now, my goal is with a Pactual Arts program, which I'll explain in a little bit, is not to sit there and try to convert the world. I'm trying to convert martial arts instructors to start teaching children an alternative way of getting a win-win out of physical altercations. You know, if you want to change something, you have to be smart enough to know how to do it. And this, the reason why I'm saying this is it loops right back to what you were talking about in some of the questions that you had given me right off the bat about my resume. One of them was being I was a missionary on the Indian reservations of Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico. And I had spent a tremendous amount of time dealing with counseling and alcohol rehabilitation and educational placement and to the Native Americans. And that's the direction I chose to go in. You know, when you grow up to being more of a peaceful person, the last thing in the world you want to do is spend all your energy trying to figure out how you're going to defend yourself in a very darker way. And my dad had a dark past. You know, he had been threatened a lot in his past, so his mind was thinking, how am I going to survive this? And not that I cannot be in the same kind of situation he was in, but I don't live in that kind of an environment where it requires that kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that what I did on the Indian reservation is they have alcohol problems. They have a tremendous amount of problems. And so one of the ways that they try to solve the dilemmas of cutting out that kind of repetitive behavior on the Indian reservation was to take the children off the reservation, educate them, and then send them back to the reservation with an education to see if they could change in future generations, and that did happen. Some of the kids wouldn't go back because it was just too much of a hole to go back to, but some of them did, and they wound up becoming tribal leaders and stuff, and it does help in time move the culture forward. And the way I look at it is if we're teaching our children modified battle and war material. And we don't even realize that over 70% of the martial arts industry are children. The only thing that we have given our children to help them in their educational journey is material they can never use. Never use. Because their environment doesn't justify anything that we teach them at all. The only time they can use that material is when they're walking home and an unusually ungodly moment happens to them. And then in that one rare moment, that's when they might need that information. So it's not that they shouldn't learn it, but the thing is that where they need material, what material they need most, is not being taught to them in the environment they need it most, which is the school. So I developed some material. And I've been teaching it. I've been developing it for 24 years. I actually developed a curriculum with a friend of mine, Cynthia Graham. And between all these years of research and working with a bunch of different schools and people, we came up with a program. I released the program a couple of years ago to about 9 different schools. One of the schools is in the Tucson school system. Students in the Tucson school system. And they've been teaching the material in the school system, after school programs, so on and so forth. The school system is just going crazy over it because they're going, this is great material. We've had 7 altercations at school, 0 suspensions. 0. And what sure. I've done is I've done the exact same thing MMA did, except for I did the buffet line and I got all the vegetables out instead of all the desserts. I figured out all the moves that you use in martial arts that you can re-manipulate a body in a different way. Because there's 2 ways that you can greet a punch. You can You can accept that punch by three ways. You can accept the punch, you can block the punch, or you can redirect the punch. And the thing is that when I see people, they're always seeing how you can demonize the bad guy so you can justify snapping his neck or breaking him in the back or whatever, you know, from all the stuff that we grew up in the 50s and 60s of yanking a guy's heart out and showing it to him in his face, that glamour of death that's been kind of in our culture for so long. And, you know, we even have it now in our video games. You know, our children are just completely engrossed in being desensitized to things that we are really traumatized. If we had the same games now when we were kids, we would have been traumatized by what we see. But nowadays,
oh, yeah,
it's actually a numbing thing. Our culture is numb to the whole situation. So I'm not stupid as to saying that, you know, it's definitely like a salmon trying to swim up the Niagara Falls. So it's definitely a difficult battle in the context of thinking how quickly you're going to be able to change the world. But you still have to have a plan, and you still have to have a goal, and you still have to believe that in what you believe in. And regardless of what the odds are, you go after it. And that's where I'm at in my life. So we did test everything, and the goal I have for Paxual Arts, and the reason why I call it Paxual Arts is if you just take the name Marshall, you take away M-A-R, and M-A-R is short for M-A-R-S. M-A-R-S, Mars, was the Roman god of war. If you look at who was the Roman god of peace, Pax was. So I went to the opposite direction, and I wasn't trying to name it after gods or anything like that. The logic that went there was, it was actually more simplified. I was teaching a passive alternative to tempo for a while, and that's what I was talking about at the beginning. I was like, oh, I'm teaching passive tempo. The title went over like a lead balloon, especially with my dad's lineage is a whole bunch of warriors all restless waiting for war. And then I come around with a peace sign, and they're all like, yay! Let's beat the crap out of this guy for thinking peace. So they did. And the funny thing was that it didn't affect me like people thought, because I'm going, yeah, well, my dad still was your instructor. And that'll never change. And that'll never change. So I don't care how loud they bark. I don't care how much they get restless about how they think my life should have been, because if they lived my life, I should have done it that way. I kind of laugh at it because I'm kind of very comfortable in my shoes. And you know, they don't understand what it was like to do with Ed Parker or his thought process, because in all fairness, the whole reason why I am today was because of the way he taught me. I am nothing more than a living laboratory of some of his thought processes just mixed with my personal philosophy. I mean, where do you think I get it from? It's funny how people would say, Ed Parker was a genius, but he gave birth to imbeciles. I think it's funny.
That is actually really funny, sir. You know, one of the things, there's two things that I really regretted in martial arts. One, I had a grandmaster that, before he got sick, asked me to teach him how to stick fight. I couldn't bring myself to do it because this was a great man. The other one was your father asking me to go out with him for a beer. And I couldn't make it at the time. Some of the things you just regret. But, God, I lost my place. I forgot where I was now. Now, after your father's passing, did you have a lot of infighting in the arts?
Oh, of course. See, most people don't understand how it was looked at. You know, when you look at it from the outside, you think that everything was cohesive. Nothing was cohesive. We're on a whole planet full of goofy humans. You want to add to the fuel to the fire? Add ego to it. And guess what? Three greatest ego industries there are. The entertainment industry, in some cases the scientific or medical industry, and the martial arts industry. Except for some of them make more money than the martial arts. So I think it's funny how big the ego gets over the paycheck. I think it's astounding.
Isn't that
the
truth?
I do believe that your ego should match your bank account. I really do.
That, absolutely. And you know, I've been with Rusty, Sequel Rusty, which is out now on Her and I have been very fortunate. We have not yet, with our guests, we've been on the air a year now, have not run into the ego problems we would have expected.
Yeah, and a lot of it, you know, in all fairness, you know, I'm already old school. You know, I was the little kid in martial arts, and yeah, there's still guys that are around that bounce me on their knees. But I turn to 54 next month, so it's not like my voice is the youthful voice of martial arts either. I'm too old to even know where it's at now, because even the people that ask me to come around are like, you know, like the second or third generation from my dad's first generation. But we're already six generations into it, type of thing. So in all fairness, you know, I'm already a dinosaur.
Oh, nice. Now, but you've had some. I mean, I remember seeing a picture of you with Elvis. You had some amazing experiences.
No, I was never with Elvis. I mean, I met him one time. There was never any photos taken. I didn't like the guy. I didn't like his music. I didn't like his music. I was a teenager, and in the middle of the night, we'd get a phone call, and I go, "Hello? Oh, who's up there?" You know, and you're just going, "Hey, Ted, Elvis is on the phone." You know, he was an irritation because he was like the midnight caller going, "Oh, great. So what, Elvis going to cry to my dad about something else? I don't know." You know, I mean, that's how you think as a teenager. You're sarcastic, and you're rude, and you're mean. And I was no different than any other sarcastic, rude, mean teenager. And you know, to me, Elvis was, you know, the guy who sang to the blue-haired grannies in church. You know, I was a Led Zeppelin fan, and Elvis was, like, what, 30 years before my time, or maybe 20 years before my time. So, you know, when you're at that age, I wasn't 20 yet. So that was before my life that he was around. So I didn't care. And so my dad, you know, that was a big deal for him, and I knew it was a big deal for him. But, you know, when you live around that stuff, too, you hear it over and over and over again. You can almost lip sync the stories, you know. And even with your own, and it's funny because now my son's doing it to me. He's rolling his eyes going, "Oh, great. I have heard that story from my dad 8 billion times." And I'm like, "Oh, now I know perspective." One time I know perspective. But
well,
me and Bruce Lee together. That's what I think you might have been referring to.
I think you're right.
Yes.
What you just posted the other day, this life came to mind.
Yeah, that's what it was. Maybe 4 or 5 pictures of my youth with me and Bruce together. There's a bunch of him at our house and a bunch with my sisters and stuff like that. And I mean, you know, it's no big deal. I mean, you know, when you look back, you know, you look at the sum of somebody's legacy and you see it's so big and glowing and so massive. But everything starts off with something. Everybody starts off as a baby. Everybody starts off their career as nothing. You know, it's just that passion, that drive, and that lucky moment that works for everybody. You know, I mean, who knows? Bruce Lee might not have had that lucky moment, and he would have been a schlup like everybody else, but he didn't. You know, he made it. And who knows? Who knows that one person who you know, if he didn't have a flat tire, might have been at the right place at the right time, and they would have gotten that great fame, you know, claim to fame. Who knows? But regardless, it happened. And regardless, when you're in the middle of the beginnings of it, you don't think about it. You know, you just think, oh, that's one of Dad's friends, one of his many friends. Because if you're in the karate industry, how many friends do you got? How many associates do you have? A gazillion. You know, it's like, it's amazing how many people, you know, are in this grassroots industry called the martial arts industry. Here's a prime example. I live in a city called Pasadena, California, and at one point we had 47 martial arts schools listed in the phone book and 2 McDonald's.
Wow.
let's not even talk about how many guys teach out of their garages. There's a ton of people teach out of their garages in Pasadena that I know, myself being one of them. Yeah, I taught at the park, and it was kind of funny. I would go down to the park and teach people, because I was always the anti-school kind of guy, because I grew up not being in a school, even though we owned schools. It's just I wasn't part of that, you know, that, I don't know, that path. You know, I didn't have to pay dues, and I didn't have to go sit there and schlep it up with the other guys in my pajamas and stuff. We didn't, you know, sweats and T-shirts and stuff like that. And it was always, I must have had 1,000 lessons from different martial artists in my lifetime. You know, it's kind of weird. I feel like I'm more like the Forrest Gump of martial arts. I just wound up being somewhere because of who my dad was. And I got a luxury that most people never got, where I got a lot of people who would say, hey, Edmund, come here. I want to share something with you. And I'm looking at him like, what for? And it goes, because you're Ed Parker's son. And I, you know, and to me, I'm like, well, you know what? That's very respectful because for some reason they find value in at least downloading this material on me. And I don't know if I felt that way at the beginning, because you know, some guys would say, you know, I had a secret cane system, and it you know, I'm going to die soon, and I want to make sure that it gets passed on, and I choose you to be my successor. Oh,
wow.
That is such an honor. However, I'm going to be straight eye to eye, man to man with you. That is so not my path. That it would be just respectful to you to even remotely give you the impression that I would want to do that. It'd be disrespectful because there's nothing about my life that wants anything to do with weapons, death, killing, or passing on that information to another human being. And part of this was that. My dad wrote a couple of books that he never published. And because I was the guy who helped publish his books and put them together, I was haunted by the need to finish his works. And I'm glad I didn't because, you know, you spend your – I have a whole life of my own. The last thing I want to do is spend it doing my dad's works. You know, I have my own life, my own interests, my own goals. And I would hate to waste my life living somebody else's dreams for them. So definitely I'm grateful that I didn't go that route. Anyway, this one guy, he wanted me to do this stuff, and it's just not my path. And I think all the culmination of all those people kind of pushing me into the MDK, murder, death, kill area. I'm talking because not martial arts in general, but that branch of martial arts that my family specialized in was self-defense. And we don't, you know, I'm being unfair to martial arts in the fact that I'm not defining really where some of my frustration is. My frustration is in self-defense, not in martial arts. Martial arts is an art form, and there's so many branches in the martial arts. It's unreal. One of those branches is self-defense. And my whole issue really is with self-defense, not any of the other things. And if you talk to other martial artists, they claim they don't do self-defense. Most of the jiu-jitsu guys aren't claiming that to be self-defense. You know, they're going, I really wouldn't use it in the self-defense situation. I'm getting in trouble. You know,
right,
and,
right.
And there's another element in there that we sometimes, you know, talk about, sometimes we don't, which is Big Brother. Hello? Everybody's got a camera now. Everybody's got a camera now. And guess when it comes out? After the first hit. And, you know, that's usually when we go into play. You know,
right.
You know, so now we have to start thinking smarter when it comes to self-defense, just self-defense. And we also have to think about evolving self-defense in today's legal environment, because that in itself is crippling. Because everything I do is well-researched, and the research that I did was I interviewed a tremendous amount of instructors about their experience with martial arts and about their experience with children and about experience with where they're going and what we're doing. And I've just taken notes all my life because that's been my interest is the teaching process. Because you know, a lot of times I go to a seminar and there's be all these guys in the room and they see me and, you know, being a martial arts dignitary / celebrity, I guess, whatever. They'd make a big deal about me being in the room, and then afterwards the instructor would be all nervous and they'd come up to me and they'd say, oh, Mr. Parker, I hope I taught good material. And I looked at them and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. I wasn't looking at your material. Oh my God! And they get offended. You know, they'd be like hurt feeling or something like that. I said, "Let me clarify that. I was looking at your teaching style. I really don't give a damn about how you teach one more person how to punch and kick. I think I'm going to throw up in my mouth if I see that again. Okay, I get it. Okay, I get it. But you know, a lot of times people at seminars and stuff like that, they're so ego driven because they have skill and a talent." And sometimes what they do is they teach with their ego instead of teaching with the ability to enlighten people's minds and their intelligence. And I'm very intrigued with the way that people can take their discoveries, put it into a verbology, turn it into a physical training, and then get the slowest guy in the room to get it. That, to me, is magic. That, to me, is care. because that way people are showing their real value as an instructor by caring to teach those that are willing to learn. And that's where sometimes I think the martial arts got it wrong. This title stuff, I'm done with it. My dad, title was Senior Grandmaster. Guess how many times he ever called himself Senior Grandmaster? Zero. Hi,
nice, right.
Parker. That was the way it was. But nowadays, people shove their titles in your face. And to me, it's like, I'm not your student, so that is not the title that you earned in my respect. I'm calling you Mr. because I don't know your first name. But in all fairness, don't shove your self-imposed importance on me. Ain't cool. I'll do that to a doctor as well. You know, I got this one guy, you know, I took my son in to a doctor. You know, he had a rash or something like that a long time ago. But I took him in, and I said, he's got some kind of rash. And the doctor yelled at me. He goes, whoa, I'm the doctor here. I'll determine. I go, whoa, I'm the customer here. I'm the customer here. You will treat me right. You know, I was mad as hell. I'm like, freaking title crap of superiority. Guess what? We all bleed and die, every one of us. You know, I got into that concept from Elvis Presley when he told my dad that one time. When my dad said, hey, Elvis, I don't get it. How come you're, you know, how is it being the king of rock and roll? How is it being such a celebrity? And Elvis told my dad this. He said, you know, Ed, I don't get it. I sit and wipe my ass like everyone else. And when I heard that, it totally made me neutralize in how I feel about other human beings. I don't get intimidated by anybody at all because it's like, you know, I'm sorry, but we all bleed and die. So, you know, yeah, I get over it, and I like to respect people as my equal. I like to respect people as my superior in their talents, but not as a human being. No human being is greater than the other. No, none is, and I think we need to get over that crap. And I think we need to be more respectful of the fact that people are people and humans are humans, and that maybe we should be a little bit more respectful towards the win-win scenario instead of always looking for the win-lose scenario. And that's at least the direction I'm going in, and that's the seeds I'm planting at this part of my life.
Oh, excellent. Well, Sensei, I have somebody to introduce you to because she's on the line, and we do have a caller. Can you take a Skype caller?
Sure.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Let me connect Sifu Rusty, my best friend in the world, that's calling from the Philippines. This is Dynamic Dojo with Master Ed Parker. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry about all the Skype fiasco. It's the internet that I'm getting here in the Philippines is okay, but not quite as fast as I'd like. So if I drop off a little bit later, that's just my internet. But it's so great to actually make it on the show, albeit like what, a half hour late. But Mr. Parker,
yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the show, and for our listeners out there. Thank you.
Sure.
For our listeners out there, our phone number here is 347-677-0699, and we have Sensei Ed Parker Jr. with us. Feel free to call in via Skype, because I'm sure if you're coming from the USA, you've got a better Skype connection than I do.
So, Rusty, let's take the Skype caller real quick for Master Parker. Skype caller, area code 111, you're on the line with Master Ed Parker. Skype caller, are you there?
Hello, Skype caller. Hello, Skype caller. Skype caller.
They could be just listening. That's okay too. Did you want to ask Ms. Parker a question, Rusty?
Yes, I did. Well, by the time I got on, I was going to ask Sensei about whether or not you felt that other people were, in a sense, holding you under your father's shadow, and you already answered that. And I was going to ask about do you experience a lot of people, you know, being in the starstruck, you know, type of thing, going, oh my gosh, Mr. Parker, oh, Sensei Master Parker, that kind of thing, and you answered that too.
I do get that all the time. And to be honest with you, I feel really bad that they have to feel that way around me, because I'm about as approachable as they get. I'm very kind. I'm very jovial. I'm a very, you know, simple, chill kind of guy. My culture is Hawaiian. I was raised in California, so I have kind of a surfer kind of Hawaiian kind of California. Hey, what's up, dude? Kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. So it's not when you have that kind of attitude, the last thing in the world you want to do is feel uncomfortable about somebody being around you.
Right. You know especially with
going,
the.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, it's Esther Parker. Oh, I was just gonna say, especially with the the Ohana spirit, right? You know, it's
right.
I bet it is kind of weird to have people going uber Asian on you and stuff like that.
You know what? It does make me feel awkward because of the fact that sometimes when you're on the road sometimes, and I'll just be honest with opening up this part, you know, when you're when you're in the position or the job that I'm in, you travel a lot. You meet a lot of people. You go all over the world. And I can see sometimes people in the background, they're nervous to come up to me or whatever. And I feel so odd, you know. So I'll come over there and sit next to them. I can see that, and I'll sit next to them, and I'll go, I say, how long will it take for you to get over being in awe with me? Would you like to pull my finger and let me fart, and then will that do it?
Yeah.
You know, I said... All I want to do is just be real and be straight up and I'd rather be somebody that if you're going to listen to me, I give you something that's poignant because of course they're going to talk to me because they want to know something or they want to, you know, be enlightened by something because when you're in a position like this, you know that you influence people and you know that what you say is taken serious because somebody goes, oh my God, Mr. Parker said this to you. To me, or Mr. Parker said that, and, you know, or Mr. Parker posted this on Facebook, or he wrote this article. And, it's kind of weird the way it gets greeted because it's not like you're thinking about something. It's not like you go up to the mountains and you're praying, and all of a sudden the great light comes down and this magical, thing comes to your mind, and you go, oh my God, I got to share this on Facebook, and it'll change the world. It's more like you just come up with a creative idea and you throw it out there, and then all of a sudden it gets quoted left and right. You're going, okay, well, I wasn't meant to be quoted. I was meant to encourage others to say something in return. It was meant to start a chain reaction. It wasn't meant to be stolen out of some holy nugget, you know?
Oh man, it must be really awkward to almost feel like, you know, around people that, you know, are in the starstruck frame of mind, to almost feel like, oh my God, do I have to now like play this role that they're expecting, you know? And that's really
you do get it a little bit because what happens is that, you know, I'm human too, and sometimes I get irritated with things, you know, like I was in Venezuela one time, and after 6 hours of signing autographs, I was done.
Right.
You know, my signature looked like an epileptic person was drawing a C. It was my hand was crippled for a week, not being able to sign my signature, and it was like when I was down there, because I don't speak Spanish and they don't speak English, and my translators weren't around me, I got bombarded, and I'd never seen this because it's weird. It was weird being in a situation where you're treated like a rock star. With a martial arts budget.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. I got 4,000 people, for women, and where's the money?
Oh, man.
Master Parker, let's take a call real quick. We got this guy's car back on. I took him solo, so now he knows.
Okay.
Cool.
Guys, caller, you're on live with Master Ed Parker. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Edmund, when are we going to movies?
Uncle Ron. Wow. Well, hello.
How you doing, buddy?
Nice caller.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. For those who don't know who this caller is, this was the man I earned my black belt from, Mr. Ron Chappelle. I did not earn it under my dad. I earned it under Mr. Ron Chappelle. And
yeah, you earned it under your dad. He just never gave it to you. He just didn't have a chance to, but you earned it.
Well,
wow.
Right on.
How you been? I have to call in the radio to get in touch with you. You're so busy.
You know what? I have been very busy, but you know what? Maybe our reunion needs to be public, so let's do that.
We'll do that.
You know, it's
most
funny.
Definitely.
You
owe me two movies.
Well, you know what? We're a little behind on that, and let me just explain even the topic of movies in a more historical context. When I was young and I was working with my dad, the only man that would rescue me from the hell of working for Ed Parker in terms of the hours, he would work me an 18-hour day. When we had a publishing deadline, he'd work me for weeks. I would take a nap, I would get up, and I'd go back to work. Use that nap on my keyboard. Now, the only man who would rescue me from that workload was Ron Chappell. He would come over, he would steal me from my dad, and we'd go see movies together. That worked for a while until one day my dad jumped in the back of the car, and then it was the three of us that would go.
That's right. Good times. Yeah. Well, you're a little behind in the movies, you know. You're pretty busy. I just
would like to hook up with you
one of these days when you slow down.
I don't see movies anymore. I really don't have the time to go out to see movies anymore. So
I really don't.
Unless it's pretty much on an airplane. I don't see it.
Yeah, I understand. You're pretty busy. I've been keeping track of you, but I know how you're constantly on the move. And for the listening audience, the Ed Parker you're hearing over the radio is the same Ed Parker that I know. He's genuine. He's absolutely being himself, and he's absolutely telling you just like it is. That's what he always does.
Well, everything else is
right on.
With the probable exception of it wasn't 18-hour days that his dad worked, and more like 20-hour days.
Yeah, but we ate. And when we ate, it was a vacation.
Exactly.
That's how Hawaiians are. We never get full. We just get tired of chewing.
That's true. But laugh, it's true.
Oh, that's funny. as I'm sitting here eating, because I'm in the Philippines right now, staying with some friends, and I've got this huge, like, plate. It's like plate lunch. I mean,
Mr.
Parker's talking about, we just get tired chewing. I'm like, I better get done chewing.
And I just had a tasty granola bar, not.
Yeah.
I would much rather have tasty Filipino food, homemade, no doubt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shut up, Rusty.
Yeah. While the wound is open, please salt it.
Oh.
Oh, she's good at doing that.
I'm shutting up right now. I'm gonna shut up.
Yeah, you're actually making me hungry as well.
Oh, so for our other listeners out there, our phone number here is 347-677-0699. We have a Skype caller on hold right now, and please be patient, area code 619. We're gonna get to you here in just a second. We had another Skype caller that dropped off. So, you know, sorry about that, folks, if you call in, you know. Just know it's like, you know, Ohana time going on over here. So we will get to your call. Believe us.
That's right. Sometimes it's like being on hold with Hewlett Packard customer service.
Look, we need to take a snapshot of this moment right here and say, wait a minute, we're spoiled with our technology. We're
I know.
So
right?
Spoiled.
Yeah.
Listen to our whining. Doggone Skype.
I know, right? Damn it, with a Skype, I can't get on, and I, like, drop off, and here's Bob going, where are you? And I'm like, dude, I'm in the Philippines, come on. Which is one thing to think. It isn't, because we got a better connection from, where was it, Germany? I don't remember. We had a better connection from, like, farther across from the Philippines, so I don't know. So that's not my excuse. So, anyhow. So, Bob, should we take another call?
Let's go ahead, and I will connect.
Bob.
Mr. 619, area code, you are
area
on live with Ed Parker.
Hey, Ed, this is Daryl Vidal.
Hello, Daryl Vidal. How are you?
How are you doing, guys? Rustina, welcome from the Philippines. I got to tell you, well, yeah, you know, we met Ed first time, and it's funny that I just heard Ron Chappell. I haven't talked to him in probably over 25 years since we did a couple tournaments together. But I met Ed for the first time at the Masters Hall of Fame this last June or July, and he was just such a nice guy, just like you said. I think we spent more time, he and my wife and his assistant, talking more about his art and just a lot of personal things about family than we did talking about martial arts at all. It was incredible.
Oh, we had a great time, and I'll be honest with you, our table was the table of envy at the place. We were laughing
it was.
And having a good time, and it's kind of funny, you know, I've always been that way at a convention, because usually, you know, I think it's kind of the irony of putting a bunch of grown men that normally are in their pajamas into monkey suits, and then, you know, it's such a contrast from the sweaty, grungy kind of lifestyle that we live. We dress up in tuxedos, we go, we give each other awards, but we sit at a table, and I don't know how many times I've gone to these things, maybe 1,000 of them, and when you sit down, you go, you know what, I would rather poke myself in the eye than be here. but I changed my tone when I said, you know what, I bet you everybody here feels the same way.
Absolutely.
And going, are you cool about this? And they're like, nah, man, I got this rental and I got the wrong side. And I'm like, and then all of a sudden you start pulling out the reality of the situation. You know, and you're going to this other guy and like, damn, that's a nice looking suit. He goes, oh my God, you know, I came here thinking I was going to laugh at me. You know, I'm like, no, that's sweet. You know, it's some guy from Chicago and he's got some kind of snakeskin suit or something like that. He goes, oh man, I borrowed it from my cousin. You know, you don't know people's backstory. You just open your mouth and you find out the humor behind everything. And you realize that, you know, people are sticking glue and gum to things to keep it together. And, you know, yeah, I mean, like the stories of people broadcasting. One time, I think Trisha Toyota, one of these newscasters, she was a big-time newscaster, and she wound up going on national TV one time, but her skirt got ripped off on the way. So she was in pantyhose. But you'd never know it because she was under a table. But, you know, it's the stuff that happens behind that makes it laugh for me, and I think that's what makes a banquet fun, is that I try to make sure that whatever table I'm at, we have a laughing good time. So that at least when people are on the other tables, it wasn't so that everybody would say, oh, my gosh, why isn't our table funny? It's more like if they're having fun, maybe I should have some fun. It's kind of
setting
an example.
I think people were coming over to our table so they can take pictures with us.
That happened a lot. That did happen a lot. But at the end of the day, we had a great table. In fact, I just spent the day yesterday with Robert, Robert Parham, which was on the same table.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
He was with me at this, I was at this, I can't remember what we call it. It's like a peace movement for veterans. And I was up in San Francisco with the VA, or excuse me, the American Veterans Association, working with them. And Robert came up and it was great. So, you know, we had a great time.
Fantastic.
Right on. I was checking to see if there were any more callers, Bob, and I don't see anybody. We're clear for
anybody.
Now.
I don't see anybody. We have Madison Paul and Daryl, and we're good. Now,
it's party.
I'm curious. You have a certificate. Your artwork is very impressive. You did the Masters Hall of Fame for next year in, like, I was told, a couple hours. It looks just amazing. Tell us about your certificate program that you have in place.
It's kind of weird the way my life works. A lot of times, the whole certificate concept started with my dad wanting a painting done so that his black belt certificate looked more impressive than just the regular certificate he was giving out. So he had me draw or paint a tiger and a dragon, and I think I was 18 at the time. But unfortunately, my skill set was also 18 at the time. I could draw pretty girls' faces, but I couldn't draw dragons and stuff. And unfortunately, when people hear you're an artist, they assume that you can draw everything, and you can't. You can only draw what you can draw. You can only have the skill set of what you have, and the rest you struggle and you try to work your way through it. And at the time, he needed more than I had a skill set to get done, but I still worked my way through it, and the original certificate was that first attempt at doing a dragon and a tiger, and it turned out to be a very, I don't know, unique certificate. And what happened was it turned into, you know, the certificate to get. But as an artist, it was an embarrassment to me because it was like a reminder of a 18-year-old kid's artwork. And the older I get, the better my artwork get, the more my past artwork would haunt me. And the way that I get past it is I just try to do another piece that would look better, you know. So that's all I wanted to do was do an upgrade 20 years after I had done that. And so I did one for the Kempo community. And the Kempo community wasn't so embracive about it because they're too much individuals, very individuals. They like to have their own thing, and there is no cohesiveness to anything. So as far as marketing a certificate to that industry, it wasn't going to work unless I made it diversified to the industry in general. So I went in that direction, and I came more from an angle of if people understood who I am in terms of passion. I'm a creative. That's who I was born to be. That's who I was raised to be. Who I'll die being is a creative. And the way that I think as a creative is how can I create a better image for martial arts since I'm in it? You know, my contribution isn't going to be to share with the world the best punch in the world or the best technique in the world or the most deadly move in the world. Mine was to help influence the culture. And the way that I wanted to do it was to make sure that what I did was change the way that martial artists get looked at. Now, we as martial artists are very proud of our arts and very proud of our training and very proud of our successes and our journey completely. However, when we decide to show the world that is not into what we're into any accolade from this industry, they never take us serious. Uh-huh. If you've seen some of the black belt certificates that are out there, it looks like a Xerox of a Xerox, and I'm going, are you freaking serious? You want to be taken serious, then you need to have something that represents it from that context. So in other words, you can't walk around we take pride in the goal of reaching a black belt or whatever title it is that we want, if we're a guru or whatever. We take pride in that title because we earned it. We worked for it. But unless we walk around with our martial arts garb, nobody's going to say, hey, you're a black belt, aren't you? You know, so... but we want that accolade to a certain degree. So what we do is we usually have it come in the form of a certificate, and that, you know, and it's usually CPA by day, martial artist by night. And so during the day, they got it on the wall. And on the wall, somebody goes by, and they're going, oh, so you're into karate, are you? And it was really to battle that, oh, you're into karate, are you, speech. I don't like that our culture, our subculture, is treated with such disrespect. But it's because of our presentation that gets it. And so as everybody else has got their little contribution to the industry, that was mine. Mine was, how can I influence the culture? And so it was really an honor. Last year, the Martial Arts Hall of Fame gave me a thing they call the Funakoshi Award. And when I was given the award, and it was presented by Diana Lee Inosanto, which is awesome, you know, and so she had me come up. And what they gave me the award for was they said that I was the most influential over the martial arts community by my artwork. That my artwork has influenced the martial art industry for three decades. And you know, it's weird when you do it and you don't think anybody's looking. I really was just trying to do something to make a difference, but the way I did certificates is different than what people think, and that is, the number one thing I wanted when somebody saw my certificate was, because it was for the person, the number one thing was, what did you do to earn this, is what I wanted to hear out of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing was where did you get it from, which gave the accolade to the studio, which wanted to take pride for it. The third thing I wanted them to say was, who did the artwork? Now, if you're just an artist, who did the artwork? I didn't want that. I didn't want that chain of command to go in that direction. I paint pretty pictures because it makes me happy, but I'm not ego-driven based on my artwork. My artwork is just because I got grounded as a kid and I got to spend a lot of extra time owning my craft. So, but I don't collect my artwork. I collect other people's artwork because I didn't have to draw it. So.
Wow, right on.
A lot more, lot more candid than you might think how things are done, but that's just, you know, that's just the way I looked at it. But to date, I've produced over 1 million certificates for the martial arts industry.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. I can't wrap my head around that.
In addition to that, I've drawn over 1,000 portraits of martial artists in my career.
Wow. Oh my goodness. And I must say it's like incredible work. When we Sifu Bob and I saw the workup for next year's Masters Hall of Fame, we had to do like a triple take. We were like, well, you know, how did they, we thought it was like Photoshop and stuff like that. And when we looked closer at it, we're like, oh my gosh, this is drawn. This is hand drawn. This is incredible. So, wow. Wow.
You know,
does it take a very long to do intricate work like that, or does it just come flowing out of your pen, so to speak?
You know,
nice way to put it. Very eloquently said.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you throw it out there in 10 minutes. That's
you know, in all fairness, if people want to see my quick work, I did, you know, the past couple of weeks post a couple of pieces of artwork on my Facebook page. It's public. So if you just look up Ed Parker and you see anything that looks like my mug as a picture, you know it's my page. Anyway, there's a couple of pictures I posted on there. One I did, it was a speed painting of Bruce Lee. It was about an hour. It took me maybe 40 minutes. But, but you know, a lot of times you speed it and you go to the bathroom and come back. So I don't know, around an hour. And then I did another speed painting of Elvis. Now, the reason why I did it is because I get bombarded by people who ask me to talk about stuff that has nothing to do with my life. I was, you know, when people ask me, what was Bruce Lee like? Did you ever train with him? I said, well, let me ask your first question first. He was tall. Oh, really? I thought he was a short man. I was 5.
Oh!
Oh! I'm sorry that Bruce didn't pull me in the back room to give me his secrets and tell you, you know, wait for this moment to teach it to you.
Wow.
So, you know, my humor can be taken as sarcasm sometimes, and it's not meant to be derogatory sarcasm. It's meant to be more like lighthearted sarcasm about the lunacy of the question, you know, because they don't know the perspective. And it's not meant to make somebody feel bad. As it is, it's just my style of humor. But at the same time, it's to let people know, it's like, guys, stop the hero worship and all this other stuff, you know. It doesn't come from that angle. Just, you know, show up real. But it's amazing how many people bombard me with Bruce Lee questions and Elvis questions. And I come across as almost not liking the two of them, and that's far from the truth. So I did artwork of them to at least say, look, if you want me to say something about them, let me do it through artwork, you know. Let me do it that way instead of asking me, so when Bruce Lee knocked on your door, did you answer the door or did Those are the kind of questions I get, you know. Have you guys ever heard of that Star Trek? William Shatner did a Saturday Night Live skit where he was doing a mock of a Star Trek convention. And so he was standing at the pulpit, and he was taking questions from the group. And there's like John Lovitz is there with pointed ears on. He's all like, Mr. Shatner, in episode 22, you went into your room and you had a safe. What was the combination? And he sits there and he goes, I really don't remember. Oh, okay. And they just kept asking the dumbest of questions. Then finally he has a meltdown and he gets angry and he goes, you, with the pointed ears, move out of your parents' basement, get a job, get a life. It was a job for me. I just went, I did my thing, I went home. That's it. I'm an actor. I did a job. It was a role. Play a part, get paid, go home. That's it. I wasn't Captain Kirk. It was just a job. And I just started laughing because I kind of feel that way about sometimes. I was in England one time. And for some reason, when the further you are from Hollywood, the bigger the passion there are for some of the American stuff, or like Elvis or Bruce or whatever. Bruce wasn't. Of course, he's from China. But my point being, it's his fame a span from the Americas. So when you're in Europe and stuff like that, you get into that kind of odd questions of, oh my gosh, so Mr. Parker, did you answer the door, or did your dad? That's the kind of questions you get. And you're just looking at them going, you really need another passion. You really do. I mean, you really need it. seriously.
It kind of makes me wonder. It makes me wonder where some of the questions come from, because in their head, it's a bona fide question.
And I never like to bring up names, because it really isn't a name that and you get that people get flustered or they don't mean to be rude. And if they for one brief moment were in my head, they'd say, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to." They would know. Immediately they go, "Holy crap, was I an idiot? I should never have said that." But at the same time, you never want to treat anybody as if they were the 8 millionth person to ask you that same question, because that person was never the person that asked that to you. And so it is at least my goal to never make somebody feel bad about, no matter how stupid the question is to me, it wasn't to them. And that's not fair to make them in their moment of discomfort, because it's a lot of courage sometimes to go up to somebody that you see is maybe a dignitary of something in your industry. It's a difficult task to be able to sit there and say hello, let alone having the guts to ask a question, letting alone the right question. Because they might have had 50 questions and they thought, well, let me ask the easy one. And you don't want to make them feel bad, but sometimes if it's question number 8,022 for the day, you kind of get snippy or get a little sarcastic, and that's the only thing that winds up on Facebook. And then you're going, oh man,
I gotta watch
myself.
Well, let's go ahead and take another caller. We've got another one of our hosts here on the Seika Network, April Vidal. She's the host of The Bucket List. How you doing, April?
Well, hello, Robert, Rashida, and Mr. Ed. How are you doing, Ed?
Well, again, we have another table mate from the Masters Hall of Fame calling in.
Well, I have a very important question to ask you, and I hopefully you'll answer it very respectfully. So when Bruce Lee came over,
who
answered the door?
Because that's the first time you asked me that question. In all honesty, I did. I did.
Oh, I love you, April.
And when I did, I was yanked away from the door saying, "Hey, don't answer the door." And that was the real story.
Wow, thank you. I appreciate that very honest and respectful answer. And I'm really excited to say hello to you and talk to you, because I know sometimes we talk on Facebook, just instant message. And I wanted to kind of ask you, being the host of The Bucket List, I know you've talked about, some past things you've done and what you're currently doing, but my interest is always, where is a person going, or what are some of the dreams that somebody, just an average person like you and me, like you said, we all wipe our butt the same. I'm just curious. I don't know, front to back to front.
Better word,
I don't know. there are variations, Ed. So, being an artist.
You know what? Thank you. Maybe I should have done with the Irish, the arse.
The arse.
Well, so my question would be then, what is something that you've always wanted to do that you haven't done yet?
Are you asking me about my bucket list?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know what's in your bucket.
I don't mean to be morbid, but I'm 54 years old, and my dad died 5 years from the date,
Right.
He died at 59, and I'm 54 years old. And I one of my bucket lists is to make it past 59. I'm healthier than he was. I'm in a good place in my life right now as far as mentally and physically. I've lost, I think, 50 pounds in the past 2 years. I weigh less now than I have in the past 30 years. And so from that place, you know, I feel like, you know, at least I've got a good running start at making it past 59. But if you were told that you have 5 years left, then you really want to make sure that you get what you want done. And not that I feel like I'm going to die in 59. I feel like I'm still, like, in my 30s. So I don't feel like I need a cane or anything like that, or I need to plan out my plot or anything like that. But it does make a person wonder where your life is going to go. And it does, you know, like my dad had that same thing with him. What happened is one day he called me up, and I was actually living in Hawaii. I was working on a TV show called Magnum PI, and I won a film I had done in Hawaii for the State Film Festival, and it got me a job on Magnum PI. And my dad says, "Hey, I know you started your Hollywood career and everything, but I think I'm going to die, son, so do you think you can help me with my life work?" Wow. Gee, since you put it that way, sure, I'll give up my career. No guilt there.
Yeah.
So I gave up my career and my direction at that point, and I did do that, and it put me on the path that I did. And so, you know, I'm at that point now where I'm older than my dad was when he gave me that speech, but I'm still in that point in my life where I have my life work that I want to get done. My life's work is so ingrained with my personal life that I have a peaceful self-defense system I developed. My goal is to teach it to all 50 states on a tour. I only want to go to one city per state, and I want corporate America to pay for it. I do not want anybody to pay for it in the martial arts industry, and I want to teach martial artists and law enforcement, whatever, free of charge is the goal. Of course, I don't have the money now, so don't come knocking on my door for free, because I'm not the one that's going to pay for it. But the goal is that I just, you know, if you want to make an impact, you got to make a big impact. And by putting in a category called Pax Alerts, I can get it on TV. I can get it on every news, you know, morning news show across the United States. And that's why I want to go to one metropolitan city in each state. But you can get a movement like that going, all I want to do is convert 50 people to the program. And it's a two-day course that teaches you how to convert your martial movement into a pactual movement and absorb a philosophy. And it's a whole different way of absorbing things, but it's a formula. You mix a formula with a philosophy and talented people already, you're going to get something to change dramatically in a short amount of time, and that was my goal. But as I do that, it was also a trip for me to be with my son. He's 18 years old, and I want to share with him my life of what it was like on the road, but now I get to show him as an adult what it was like. Hey, son, when I went and did this seminar, I went to see this monument, or I went to go see this, you know, this thing. So it's like, it's kind of a weird thing. When my dad died, I did that without him. I traveled the world. I was in the weirdest of places. I was in a pub in the middle of southern England and the only surfing town in England. And, you know, everybody would go, "Oh, Mr. Parker, let's go have a pint." We go into some little dive in the middle of nowhere. And there's a picture of my dad.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, whoa. So I spent a huge chunk of my career, you know, kind of falling in the same, you know, travels that he did. But I never got him. You know what I mean? I never got that. And the cool thing was that I missed those years in my youth, but I got him back as an adult, because when I traveled the road, I got the stories that I didn't get because he was gone. But I've been to those places now, and I've gotten those stories now, and I feel edified as a son, and I feel like I've got those missing years back. But now I can do that to my children, where I can sit there and say, instead of waiting for me to die, you tracing that, how about I take you with me? So
wow.
So we're going to take we're putting together a tour bus, and we're going to do a tour of the United States. I'm going to raise instructors on the tour. So I have a bunch of guys that have been training with me for a while, and I'm going to take them on the bus with me, and then I'll dump some of them off saying, okay, you know enough, now spread the word. I'll put more people on the bus, and I'll just keep it going until we make it a world tour. And, of course, because I'm an artist and I'm a adventurer and everything else, I want to see it all. So teach peace and then go look at the Grand Canyon. Go teach peace and go look at Bryce Canyon. Go teach peace and go look at Craters of the Moon. Go teach peace and go look at Mount Rushmore. You know, go teach peace and go to the White House. You know, go teach peace and go look at the Smithsonian. You know, go live. I mean, you know, there's a movie that was written by Stephen King. It's called The Shawshank Redemption, and Morgan Freeman played this one role of a character, but he said these words. He said, get busy living or get busy dying. And to me, it's like, really? That's what we need to adopt, that philosophy in everything we do. Are you just dying? Because, you know, the person that lives for the six-pack at the end of the day, they're just waiting to die. They
exactly.
really are. The person that you know, can't wait to go to bed and can't wait to sleep in, they're just waiting to die. I mean, literally, you know, a person that puts in their 9-to-5 and they expect more out of life from only putting in the bare minimum, come on. Literally, I mean, if you're a person of passion, if you really genuinely care about your goals or about making a difference in life and stuff like that, or in your life, or even in one person's life, sometimes that means you have to wake up early and go to bed late all the time because you're driven by something. And that's how I am. I'm driven. I am absolutely driven. I go to bed late every night. In fact, I was saying at the beginning of the show, I drove to San Francisco 8 hours up, 6 hours there, 8 hours back. I mean,
wow. And you're still awake.
And 2 days before that, I was 2 days of editing. I've been working on a video on my Paxual Arts. It's so hard to explain what I'm doing, so I'm going to be releasing a video this week. So if you see it, I'll release it on Facebook and stuff like that. And I am going to ask people to look at the video, and if you get it, I'm going to ask you guys to link it to every single person you know, because it'll make sense to you. I really have a plan that's going to change the planet. And I'm coming from an angle where it's not going to cost a lot of money either. It's a cause. And, you know, I do believe that people, you know, I have it happen. The past week, we got a pledge from the American Veterans Association to help back our tour. So
wow.
it is showing that what we're trying to do and how we're trying to do it is being greeted. It literally is. I'm teaching a win-win scenario,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I'm teaching it. And I'm not trying to teach this to adults, because a lot of times people hear my program and they're going, "How dare you, Mr. Parker, take away my MA?" Seriously, dude. You think I'm going to go
wow.
ahead and yank it out of your head and your soul? No. What I'm doing is you have a tool belt, right? Not everything requires a sledgehammer, okay? sometimes the job might require a chamois because you polish instead of smash. So
mm-hmm.
the thing is that we always have choices in life, and all I'm saying is, and this is the angle I'm coming from, why are we not teaching our children those choices? We're teaching our children the beginnings of murder, death, kill is the solution. Why are we not teaching our children
mm-hmm.
a win-win? Why are we teaching our children crescent kicks? And then, and I've interviewed kids, and I say, how do you feel comfortable about the material you're taught? Oh, my gosh, I love the tournaments. I love the competing. I love. Yeah? Would you use this in the street? Oh, no way, man. No way. Oh, man, are you? They get all scared.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to kids. I mean, listeners that are hearing this, talk to kids and ask them the questions about how comfortable they are about using the material we teach them in a self-defense situation. And you're going to be shocked what they tell you, because I have interviewed them and I have heard what they said. When it comes to competition, they're cool about it. When it comes to using this to defend their lives, they're not confident with it. They're not. And the thing is that you got to put them in a situation where we got to listen to who our audience is. We're adults
mm-hmm.
that are saying, oh, yeah, we demonize everything. Yeah, but you know, he's just a rapist and a killer.
Yeah,
I mean, you know what? What parent allows their kid to be around a rapist and a killer? You know? Pick your kid up from school. Don't allow them to go through rapist and killer alley. You know?
Right.
You know? Wake up. You know, why are we arming our kids with the least denominator of information they could use? You need to teach them. So the goal is as I travel, is to teach a martial artist that teach children to come and train for 2 days and learn this formula and learn this stuff and entangle it within their knowledge and skill set and see what they come up with. But this is it's a really cool program and everything else. And I have over 200 certified people, and I have and so you know how big of a deal this is. It's kind of funny. Martial artists will look at it and they go, I don't get it. It has nothing to do with murder, death, kill. I don't get it. And yet I've talked to a tremendous amount of people outside of the martial arts industry. I've never gotten more support in my entire life for anything. And what it's done is it's changed my focus from being an artist, and that because art is great, because I wanted to, you know, paint period pictures and bring smiles to faces and leave a legacy as an artist and so on and so forth. But you know what that does? Besides paying my bills, it feeds my ego. And I don't want just to have my ego fed. I would like to make a difference. And so by doing something like this, I leave a greater legacy than just being the son of Ed Parker. At least a greater legacy than a guy who just made pretty pictures to make people smile, you know, or make cool certificates so people have an ego stroke for the moment. You know, life can be better than that. And I have to survive this life with a better legacy than where I started. And that's where I'm at. And so, yeah, that's my bucket list.
Well,
you know,
thank
it's a three-year
you for
course.
Answering that. Well, I appreciate that, too, because as I'm sitting, you know, listening to you, you're definitely inspiring me to kind of think about my bucket list and, you know, this whole thing with the ego and how that ties in and, you know, what is really the purpose of when you talk to children and when you teach children and where are you going with that idea and getting involved because they're the ones that follow. So that is, you know, definitely the most important thing is, pardon me, yeah, exactly, and just when you go for the children and you know, this plan that you have, I mean, this sounds phenomenal. I mean, I want to know more about this, and please do, anything you want to share, you know, with myself and probably Rusty and Robert as well and anybody to advertise and post and you know, I want to understand it more because I'm not a martial artist. So some of the things that you talk about, I'm very intrigued about, and I want to learn more. So I appreciate you answering that honestly and inspiring me. So thank you, Mr. Parker.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, I have to head out, all of you. So thank you so much. I will continue listening tonight.
Thank you.
Have a great night, everybody.
Okay.
Thank you too, April.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks, April.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. As April said, April says bye. Okay, two more things for you, April. I know you're still listening. I want to go to Machu Picchu. I want to go to Easter Island. There we go.
very good.
Very cool.
I'm also an archaeological buff. There's a place called Pumupunku in Colombia. Mm-hmm. I want to see. If any of martial artists out there just happen to be nutsy enough to also go into the whole ancient alien TV show and stuff like that, I kind of like to watch that show, even though I'm not really buying into the whole alien thing, meaning I don't discount it, but to me, I'm more intrigued by what we find on Earth, and I'm more intrigued by, you know, all they do is ask questions. Could it be aliens? I was like, I don't know, but I just want to see what it is. You know, I don't draw a conclusion as to anything. I'm intrigued by stuff that's been built thousands of years ago or you know, ridiculous amount of years ago, and we mathematically can't duplicate it. And those are things I'd like to see. So in terms of a bucket list, I'm always intrigued by stuff like that. So if my travels are lucky enough to let me be close enough, like I'm supposed to go down to Chile again. Chile's like halfway, or the Easter Island's halfway between Chile and Tahiti. And there's not a whole lot of people from Tahiti asking me to teach seminars. So it looks like the only way I'm going to get to Easter Island is to get there from Santiago, Chile. So we'll see. Hopefully I'll get down there.
Very cool. Very cool.
So you mentioned,
we are back.
Yes, Mass Parker, you mentioned about internship on Magnum PI. Can you expand a little bit about your entertainment industry background? I know you were on The Dragon. You portrayed your father on the Bruce Lee movie, The Dragon. Can you tell us about your entertainment career?
Well, my entertainment career actually started in church, where they just started having church plays. And I just liked having, you know, the whole acting thing. So I wound up doing a lot of stage plays and maybe done 50 of them or so in high school and different things. And I got to college with a scholarship for art and a scholarship for theater. And so it was great, you know, college for free. So I chose to go to Hawaii to go to college, it was a wonderful experience. In fact, I didn't like my high school years, but I think we all look back in our lives and we say, if we could go on a time machine, what era would you like to spend most time again? It would be college. And my college years was different because I was in a religious college, so it wasn't a, it wasn't because of partying and stuff like that. It was on the North Shore of Hawaii, and so I wasn't a party guy. It was kind of funny. Everybody would go, hey, Ed, let's go to Honolulu and party our butts off, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. And the reason why is because when I was given art assignments, and you know the instructor would say, put in a minimum of 6 hours, and then when the art project would be due, they'd look at the artwork and they everybody would say, oh my God, Ed, your artwork is amazing and your projects are amazing, and I said, well, you know why your project looks the way it does? I go, because you put 3 hours of work into it. I said, I put 30 hours into mine. And they said, yeah, but the requirements were only 6 hours. I said, no, the minimum was 6 hours. You get what you put into it. And so I had that same attitude with everything I did, including making films. And so I started to make these films with, you know, other students and stuff like that. And I come after any art project as if it's the same, whether it's on film, whether it's on paper, whether it's three-dimensional. Creativity is creativity. You're just creating something. And film is no different than any other art project. So we treat it as an art project, and it was like a little horror film. And coming up with clever ideas and working with a stupid budget and trying to make it as fun as possible. And we entered it in the State of Hawaii Film Festival, and it won. And we entered another film in the State of Hawaii Festival, and it won again. So they gave the team on it internship with Magnum PI, and I was the only one who was able to take it. So I literally was part of it for about a week before my dad gave me the guilt speech. I passed the torch on to another friend of mine, and he's still in that industry today. He wound up doing Lost. He wound up doing every show that's been involved in Hawaii just about, and that would have been my career. So I'm glad it wasn't. You know, I'm glad that I'm glad it went the way it was, because then I wouldn't have had, you know, the impact that I had in the areas I have. So no regrets about having anything different, but that's, you know, I wasn't really on it that long. But because my other friend was there, I got to visit the set and meet everybody and stuff like that. But when I went up to California to work for my dad, that was the end of that career. When my dad died, you know, you get to thinking, okay, where does my career go now? And so part of it was we were working on a TV show called Challenge of the Masters, which is basically it was supposed to be the WWF of martial arts. Because the WWF was, most people don't get, it's choreographed.
Right.
There's a bunch, you know, the whole thing, and the audience is handpicked to go in certain areas to only fill it with a camera and stuff like that. There's all these tricks that you do to make sure that it looks like it's a full arena. And I learned some of the tricks because one of the executive vice president that left the WWF was on our team, and we're working with Fox Television at the time. And we're really excited about this project. And the reason why I wanted to go in this direction is that the WWF, it caters to really big guys. And if you went into a martial arts environment, you can get more of the acrobatic size. So you can show a whole different level of execution of material than you can with just big guys. And I thought that would be a really cool angle. It wasn't my original idea, but I was on the team, and that's what we were going towards. And after working on that for, X amount of years, the plug was pulled, and it never happened. And I got so bitter with that direction because it's Hollywood is a nauseating experience if you don't have success, because it means a whole lot of meetings over drinks and a whole lot of bragging over past experiences and a whole lot of strip clubs and bars and stuff like that that you have to have meetings at, and no results. It's just going, hey guys, I like doing business like that. This is not my style of doing business. Hey, let's go to a strip club. And sometimes you see these guys from Hollywood, they'd spend, in a certain part of my life, but I don't drink now, but at the time, you know, the guys would say, hey, let's have drinks, and they'd pour these drinks that were $45 a shot. And they spend a round on 20 people and go, hey, let's have 5 shots each of $45 each, you know. Oh, everybody, let's go. And I'm looking at that going, that's ridiculous. You know, we could all have had a beer, been happy, and you could have donated that money to something more worthy than somebody who wants to charge you $45 a shot, you know. I just didn't like the industry. I didn't like the way people did business or anything like that. And so my last effort to be involved was when Universal Pictures called me up And they said, hey, you know, we're doing a Bruce Lee movie, and we'd love for you to come down and help us with, you know, giving him some insights to part of his life, and we want you to come down, and we want you to see our screen test on Jason Scott Lee, who we're going to have play the part, and why don't you come down to Universal. And, you know, it was really cool because, you know, you go to Universal for the first time, and you're not on the tour. You know, you're in a back mm-hmm. gate, and you have a security guard there who normally would shoot you in the head for, you know, stepping over 2 feet over the line, and you can drive through, and it was like, woohoo, you know, you can drive again. And you're going down these streets, and you're seeing all the Hollywood going on behind the sets, and you're seeing the tour buses go by for Universal Studios, and you're going, yeah, that's right. I'm not in the tour bus. I'm in a car. Yeah. I'm part of the crew here. Yeah. Making billion-dollar movies, buddies. You know. So anyway, you got this little moment of glory as you pull up to the place, and you see these guys, and they're like, one of the producers was Dino De Laurentiis' daughter, Rafaela De Laurentiis, you know, and yeah, he's like the guy who made Apocalypse Now. So, and she's an Italian woman with an Italian accent, so she's all like, so Ed, darling, can you get us these people for the tournament? We need to fill the place with many people. Can you help us? You know, and I'm sitting there going, I'm cracking up because it's like, this is so not my industry or my business, you know, and I'm seeing this guy, he's done like 50 movies, and he worked with all the celebrities and stuff like that. It's a really interesting concept, just being in that environment for a brief moment. And, you know, they had me read my script and stuff like that, and they asked me to help participate in producing a portion of it. And I got there, and I gave them the footage of what happened, and they go, well, that's not exactly how it fits in our dramatic storyline. Oh, well, that's truth. and you're interested in dramatic license. Okay, I get it. It's Hollywood. We're cool. So the whole scene I did in the Bruce Lee story was fictitious. All of it was. There's not one thing in it that was real, except for nothing was. My dad wasn't the center referee in the movie. We didn't have a ring with ropes. It wasn't filmed at the Glendale YMCA. I mean, we didn't have it. It was filmed at the Glendale YMCA, but we didn't, you know, it was filmed at, it was actually done at the Long Beach Auditorium, which has since been torn down. But, you know, it's like, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that you think Hollywood would represent the truth, but then after a while you realize that Hollywood mm-hmm. is not entertaining. And it's not about truth, it's about entertaining. And so I got interviewed a lot, and then I had to make that differentiation. I said, you know what, you want to know about Bruce Lee's life, watch a documentary film. If you want to be entertained about the essence of him, watch Bruce Lee, the movie, or Dragon, the movie. Because the movie here was the deal, the background story about it. Hollywood had the script for a number of years about doing the Bruce Lee. They had the rights to do the Bruce Lee story for eons. But they were waiting for the right script to come in because his story wasn't compelling enough. And so the angle they wanted to come from is they didn't want to just attract a male audience. So the way that Hollywood thought was come more from a love story. It was a white woman and a Chinese man struggling in a prejudiced time in American history. The Black Panther movement was going on. There was a lot of prejudice towards other cultures, other races. And the story was more of trying to appeal to a woman audience and a man's audience. So it was designed to be more of a struggle of a couple. Of a man that was famous. And so when you hear it from that angle, then you go, okay, I see the story you're trying to tell. And so as long as you mm-hmm. know that, you're not caught up in trying to go and see truth in a Hollywood movie. Because there's a whole bunch of it that's just not true. But if you see really what they were trying to do is they're trying to honor him and Linda Lee as a couple, you know, a white woman married a Chinese man and the struggles of the prejudice of the time. And from that angle, mm-hmm. what success it was to at least come and express that in a film. And I like that angle. But like I said, truth, nah. As far as Hollywood is concerned, I still get lunch money from that movie. Woo-hoo!
Wow.
I did that like in 93. And here it is 20 years later, and I still get a check in the mail every quarter for, I don't know, like $60. So, woo-hoo! So,
I remember when we went to go see the movie Dragon, and a bunch of my students and a bunch of martial arts friends were like, "That ain't true. That ain't true. That ain't true." So I hope they're listening, you know, right now, you know, that it was for entertainment as opposed to historical content.
I had to decipher that myself too, because I was really irritated by myself, because you feel like you're part of the lie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're acting, you're going, "This isn't what happened. I gave you the film. It was peaceful." You know? Bruce Lee wasn't there with the white pants and his shirt off. He had his, you know, his kung fu uniform on. And everybody's sitting all reverent. And, I mean, to be honest with you, if anybody showed his demonstration today, you know, the audience would fall asleep. I mean, showing a one-inch punch is not very exciting. You know, nowadays you have to have some kid with a shirt off doing 82 backflips, and then the audience goes, "Yeah, I saw that."
Ooh.
<You know>?
Right. Right.
Oh, are you kidding? He only kicked 42 boards? Huh. Have you kicked 42 boards flaming? I don't think so. So, I mean, you know, what we expect as an audience is so much different. If what Bruce Lee did back then, did he did it now? Nobody would have cared, but it was his personality. I mean, he was a pioneer of what he did, and, you know, nobody could dispute what he did and how he did it, but at the time, because he was the first, he paved the way. But like I said, you know, if you see some of the footage of what was done, there's nothing exciting about any of it. It's just historical, but not exciting, you know. I mean, nowadays, at the time, wow, how did he get that one-inch punch to be so effective? Now we know the science of it. It's all based upon the utilization of pulling in height, width, and depth, using your body weight, using your rotational force, using your depth of penetration, using the culmination of your three dimensions to get the ultimate amount of power out of your strike. Well, we know what that is now because we've taken the time as a culture, as intelligent people, to discover that instead of throwing it in the realm of mysticism, because that's what people have done in the past. That's just the master's knowledge. No, it isn't. It's science. It's physics. And it's the knowledge of how to apply physics and science and human and human anatomy. And that's all that was being, you know, done. But the problem is that at the time, too, is we didn't have the terminology to help the others discover this. So when we were taught, it was like, no, just, you know, practice makes perfect. If you, repetitiveness, you'll get it. But that's not the road to discovery of that stuff. And so what happened is that when more intelligent people entered the industry, they were able to at least bring some knowledge of physics and kinetics and anatomy and intermix it with martial arts. Because a lot of times, like for instance, the guys that I was exposed to that were my dad's classmates and some other guys that, you know, were from that lineage, this is the way they talk. "Yeah, let's go down to the Kempo school and go bang them out on the map." You know, they don't, and then they talk to me, "And your dad was, he was a one smart guy, you know, he kind of put that scientific stuff for all that kind of punching and stuff, but for us, we just like to sweat them out and bang them up on the map." And that's kind of the mentality. They didn't really go into depth over stuff. I'm not really into the fancy kind of stuff about the angles of this and that. All I know is, hey, you get in my way, I knock them out. And it's just,
that's right.
That's just where it was, you know. So, you know, so there was people that wound up, you know, not being so, you know, activity oriented. You know, it was an activity for some. It was a passion to train and work out. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't till, you know, my dad and people like my dad came with an education. You know, my dad had a college degree in sociology and psychology, and he did that because he knew he was going to be in business doing martial arts. And his intelligence was, well, if I'm going to be with people and I'm going to be teaching people, then I better know people. So he became, you know, he got his degree in sociology for that reason. And most people don't understand that. And his knowledge also expanded further by studying anatomy and so on and so forth. And that's where my knowledge came from as well. I studied anatomy as an artist. I went to medical school, and I asked to go and look at cadavers and check things out because as an artist, I wanted to know what was under the skin. I wanted to know how things work so that if you're drawing it, you know anatomy. And so I learned anatomy too. And when I helped my dad accomplish some of his publications, I had to illustrate anatomy. I had to illustrate where the target trigger areas. I had to talk about the cause and effect of each area of the body. And what, you know, if you hit them with this natural weapon like a middle knuckle or a punch or this, you can cause temporary paralysis. You can cause heart murmurs. You can cause, you know, blood clots, or you can cause possible death. And he wrote it all down. He broke it all down, and I was the guy who was responsible for illustrating it. And there was a point where I was talking about earlier about my dad. He had a book that he was writing. One of them was called Speak with a Knife. And I got a hold of his book, and I started to say, you know what, I'm going to do some research, and I'm going to look at his works, and I'm going to try to republish his book since he never finished it. And when I looked at his book and I started to illustrate it, you really cannot do a knife book unless you show really what it does, because otherwise it's a bunch of dotted lines showing the direction of a knife. But the way his book was written, it was about the cause and effect of each knife strike. Like, for instance, he had 50 terms of different ways of having a knife enter a skin. Like, he called it butterfly cuts. And that was when you take two blades, you take the tip so that it leaves almost like a butterfly tip, and you flick it on the skin. And what it does is it causes a break in the skin where it's really hard to stitch.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to put a stitch there. And so the only way you're going to really show the effectiveness of the hit itself is to show what it does to the skin. So as an artist, I started taking – I'm also a Photoshop master, and so I took photos, and I started to show exactly how the skin will fold back, how deep the cuts are, without showing the blood in the guts. I was able to show what it looked like. And I was about maybe a quarter of the way done on the book, and I go, I can't do it. I can't finish this book. I do not want to be responsible for showing anybody how to cook a human being. It's not that my dad was doing it, but some psycho is going to get a hold of this, and somebody's going to do something about it. You know, and I'm like going, you know, and I was part of it. So you know what? It's going to stop here. And it was a culmination of a lot of that stuff that got me on the path that I'm on now. But, I mean, I just didn't want to be responsible. It was ugly. I mean, it wasn't ugly to him because it was more the science of what you could do. But to me, it's like I know how many dysfunctional people are also in the martial arts industry and what they do with it.
Yeah.
And I say that in a reverent way because some of my best friends, some of the most intelligent people, some of the most talented people in the martial arts industry. But unfortunately, the martial arts industry is kind of like a religion, it's like a church in a way. And I'll explain what I mean. It's like some people go to church because there's a social interaction and they depend on that social interaction. And I know we know schools that are like that. They're so close that they depend on each other. They train with each other, and sometimes their duration is 5-10 years together, right? And that's what they do is they have this bond. And sometimes people are just they don't have a church to go to. They don't have a social group to go to, so they have karate. And some of these people have been in it for 50, 60, 70 years. I got a guy who's in his 90s. He bounced me on his knee, and he's still teaching. You know, and I'm like, I'm almost 55, you know, it's like, you know, it shows how long people are in it. But the thing is that even though they've been in it a long time, it doesn't mean that they're the sharpest knife in the drawer sometimes. And sometimes people throw a lot of rank around people who've been around a long time because they've been around a long time. They're not the smartest guy in the world. They just didn't have a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed in karate over and over and over again. The young people go, man, this guy's been around forever. Let's put rank on him. And this guy, he's like barely alive, barely cohesive, you know, can barely make a punch hit, and he's got this big rank around him and stuff like that. And it just threw things off. It just did. And so what happens is a lot of times these people that wind up as masters, it's like, okay, truck driver or karate master. You have to take a test to be a truck driver, right? I'll pick karate master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guarantee you, there's a whole bunch of guys out there who couldn't fight their way out of a wet paper bag, and they have the title master attached to the first of their name.
Right.
And a lot of it happened because of that way. It just happened because they won by default. They just never left. They don't have a skill set,
mm-hmm.
but they're just there. They're the intelligence.
Wow.
But they're there. And I'm talking old school stuff, too. I'm not taking mm-hmm. this the new world because the new martial arts industry, I'm the dinosaur. I'm the echo. I'm the child of, like I said, I was 5 when Bruce Lee was around. How long ago was Bruce Lee gone? A long time ago. You know, so it's a whole different industry. I mean, I was pretty shocked when I was asked to go to a tournament and I saw like 15 kids out there with their shirts off doing backflips. I'm like, what does this have to do with martial arts? Okay, I'm old. What is this crap? What is this 15 people jumping onto each other and jumping off? I'm old. I'm already boxed like an old person. You know, when you're going, you know what, my day, we never had that. And the thing that got me the most is when I saw some kid come up to me and he get all cocky. Like, I had this kid come up to me, and I was in an elevator in Baltimore. And I'm really a chill guy, and I never go by titles or anything like that. I never say I'm master of this or anything. Like, I could care less. I hate titles. I respect that people respect titles. It's just a personal thing for me. So, you know, if somebody calls me that, I never correct them or anything like that. I try to correct if I can because I don't consider myself a master. I think a master is nothing more than a person who really, really has – the only thing a master, in my opinion, is a person who masters the basics.
Mm-hmm.
Not masters – you know, you don't master life. You don't master the advanced stuff. You master basics.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what a master is. Because a person who masters basics can do anything within that realm because you have the foundation done. And so you haven't mastered discoveries. You haven't mastered all that there is to learn. What you've mastered is the foundation of how to get it learned. And so I like putting it in a perspective where you're not, you know, because master, the title master gives like you reach the end of your game. Ta-da!
Mm-hmm.
I did it. I'm a master. I know it all. So that it's a personal thing. So, no, I'm not disrespecting those who choose that title. It's just the angle where I come from with that. But the thing is that here I'm watching, you know, this kind of stuff, and I'm seeing the evolution of this. But I'm in an elevator. I see this kid come in. He might have been 12. He's got a solid red bar on his black belt. And he looks at me and he goes, "Hey, Ed." And it's the first time I wanted to smack a kid. I wanted to slap him so hard that his head turned around like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. You know? I'm like, wow. You know, it's the first time in my life I go, "It's Mr. to you." I never did that in my life, but I just was so angry. I'm looking at that kid going, you know, and then I got, you know, then I, after my 3 minutes of irritation getting by, then I was angry at his instructor and his parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally
mm-hmm.
angry at his instructor and his parents. I'm like, and his instructor.
Exactly.
Who the hell gave this 12-year-old a fifth degree? That you know, that made me want to go and smack his
right.
instructor. You know, I'm like, you know, and the other thing is that, you know, then I got over the kid and then I got to thinking, wait a minute. Who the hell gave this kid the belief that he could actually do something? His weight does not
exactly.
equivalent his rank. And so when that kid gets his proverbial ass kicked, then he's going to – his self-esteem is shot. He's going to be in therapy for the rest of his life because he's lived his whole life believing that his crap don't stink, that he is
mm-hmm.
the king and that he can do his – he can deliver. But his weight and his size and his ego could not match what he thinks he could. And
right.
that was not his fault. It was the people that put it around his waist. It was his parents from allowing him to get away with that by not smacking him in the right moment. And so that, you know, that was a big wake-up call for me to say, okay, so this is where we're at with our kids? Is this what we're doing with our children, is giving them false sense of security by putting large rank around them? And you know what, they're walking around thinking they can actually defend themselves and or kick people's butts. And that's not what martial arts is supposed to be either. Because this kid was looking around, "Give me a reason to kill you. Give me a reason to kill you." That was a look in his eyes. "Give me a reason to kill you."
Wow.
Like, really? Is that what we're doing?
Wow.
And you know, unfortunately, I can only speak for my life. So, you know, I don't visit the whole martial arts community. So I'm not speaking for all of it. I'm only speaking for the branches I've been exposed to and the worlds that I get invited to. So, you know, I'm definitely not speaking for the industry in general, and I'm definitely not speaking, on a certain level. I'm speaking more to the adults here. If you're in the path and you started, yay, keep it going. If you're happy, yay, keep it going. If you see a problem, do something about it. Change it. Be proactive, because my thing is, if you see a problem and you know you can do something, you are now responsible for acting on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're part of the problem. And that's why I do what I do, because I realize there's a problem. And you know what? There's two ways. You either grumble about it and you whine and bitch, and that's what most people do. Hey, let's grumble. Let's talk about the bad things in life and never offer a solution. Well, I'm not here to grumble. I'm here to sit there and say I do have solutions. And I think that's the best way to do it, instead of just offering a negative opinion. Because it's funny, some people in my graph industry will get mad at me. I'll say, you know, Mr. Parker, you're not really a black belt, or you're not really this, or you're an embarrassment to your dad's name, or blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, I have a great comeback to them. I'm going, wow, it's nice to know your only contribution to the Kempo industry is a negative opinion. At least I go to bed at night knowing, hey, I did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I sleep like a baby,
mm-hmm.
so I have no issues.
That's right.
So I have to go deal with a problem
That's
here,
right.
which is my iPhone. So let me find a plug. Here we go.
Uh-oh.
Hey,
plug
the
plug. That in.
Yeah, technology.
Hey,
stupid
yay.
Batteries. Huh?
We're so spoiled by the technology. Okay. Now, yeah, I'm still like, my head's still going, you know, WTF about that kid that, like, met up with you in the elevator. That definitely deserves his instructor being smacked upside the head. Definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. And that's, you know, I bring that kind of stuff up because so that if people haven't had that happen, then they are aware of it. And, you know, what if you just change one person from that thought process? Then you did your job for speaking up about it, you know? It's
exactly.
The fact that we don't speak up for things that's the problem. Not grumble, not complain, speak up, or act on it in a positive way, you know, or set an example in a positive way. I remember seeing on YouTube, I don't know, a year or two ago, where I saw a beginning kid come in a dojo and they were doing some kind of, I don't know, jiu-jitsu chokehold, and they get a hold of this one kid, and this other, I don't know, he might have been another, he looked like he was like between 12 and 14, gets a hold of this brand new kid and chokes him out. He gets up and he kicks the kid off of his body, his limp body. He's completely passed out. Kicks him, pushes him off. The instructor's laughing. And they walk away without trying to revive the kid.
And I
was horrified by this. And it was on YouTube. And the guy no longer teaches martial arts. And it was definitely something that wound up on national TV. It was definitely something that our industry didn't need. At the same time, it does need it, because that kind of stupidity is out there, and it needs to be addressed, and people need to wake up. And it's like, are you comfortable with this? I think there's a thing that we don't, you know, we need to actually kind of talk to the medical industry before we start doing chokeholds, because the medical industry says, look, you got cartilage, and you have calcium deposits that wind up in the neck, and you start choking up, winds up being in the brain, and you start winding up getting aneurysms and, oh, I don't know, death. And we're playing with medical stuff, and we're acting like it's okay. It's not okay. Why are we practicing this kind of stuff? Not that it's happening, but at least I'm going to be one that says, wake up and say, let's as a subculture do a little bit more medical research as to what we're doing, because it's not healthy. It's not smart.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we teaching our children how to do chokeouts? It's stupid. You know,
right.
It's just stupid.
Right, right. Well, especially at that age.
Hollywood's given a stigma to what martial arts should be,
and
those of us who are in the industry know we don't live up to that reputation that Hollywood gives. You know, that it's supposed to be some peaceful warrior thing, and that you kind of get it all the time from non-martial artists. Well, you guys are peaceful people, aren't you?
And
actually, I said, honestly, we're a bunch of dysfunctional people, man, just like the rest of the planet. So please do not put us up there as all of us are Mr. Miyagi's and we're all walking around as a peaceful warrior, because we're not.
Right.
We're not.
That's right.
Right.
You know, We're just as human as the next, and we're struggling to make life work. And you know, unfortunately, most people don't know how people got into martial arts. Sometimes Uncle Bob loans us 10 grand and we can open up a studio. It doesn't mean that we know business. It doesn't mean we know marketing. It doesn't mean we know anything more than we know how to do karate. And sometimes we don't even know how to teach it, but we wind up teaching it. And then what happens is that we wind up raising a black belt, and then that black belt gets mad at us because we didn't know what we're supposed to do because their research says, hey, wait, you're a fraud. But they don't discount their belt. They walk out and they go, well, you're a fraud, but I'm leaving, so I'm going to start my own school.
Right. That makes, like, no sense. But, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right.
But it happens. And you know, and then next thing you know, his offspring opens up an international organization. And you're going, why are you an international organization? Oh, because my student's from Guam. Oh, okay.
One student.
So you've got a student from Guam, and you're from you know, you're from Fullerton, and wow, okay. International organization, ahoy!
I know. Guam's is still U.S. territory, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But globally, it's part of the international community. So.
Guam and Puerto Rico. You want to make an international organization. Oh, my goodness. Well, Mr. Parker, we've only got about 4 minutes on our live feed. And speaking of young people, because definitely the young people are, you know, are the next generation that's going to be making or breaking, you know, what's going on right now.
Sure.
If a young person were to come up to you and say, Mr. Parker, I want to get into a martial art. What should I look for? What should I? What can I do? What do I do? They're lost. What would you do?
Honestly, my biggest advice would be that your parents should research who the instructor is, because that person's influencing their child's life.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find out who that person's background is and what person that is. Forget about the art, because guess what? You know, there's two reasons why people do it, by word of mouth or because it's close. If they do it because it's close, then it's bare economics. And all I'm saying is you get what you pay for. Do a little research. If you're going to turn your child over to somebody else to influence your child's life, find out who they are. Spend a little time with them and find out if their personality is worthy of influencing your children. And that's all I have to say.
Very cool. Wonderful advice.
Wow, great advice.
The parents out there are listening, because, you know, there are parents out there that definitely want their own children, you know, if they are martial artists. So if the parent is a martial artist, and they definitely want their own children to get into martial arts, sometimes they even forget that you know, they don't, that their kids don't necessarily have to do the same art as they do. And because I've met a couple parents like that. Well, Johnny doesn't want to do karate, and I'm kind of pissed off about it. Well, it's like, why doesn't Johnny do something he wants to do? Like, oh, he wants to do, you know, I don't know, he wants to do Aikido? Well, check out the Aikido school down the street. Why not? So,
you know, and that would be a wonderful challenge to offer martial arts, martial artists that are our parents. That would be a great, you know, challenge for them, is to allow their children the choice. If they have a flavor for martial arts, that they allow their children that luxury of being able to choose whatever flavor they want. You know, that would be great. I know my dad did that for us. My dad did that for his offspring. When people would come to him and they say, Mr. Parker, I want to study another art. In fact, you know, one of the guys who did that was a guy named Dan Inosanto. Dan Inosanto was one of my dad's black belts, and he said, I want to study the Filipino arts. I'm Filipino. My dad goes, go with my blessings. And I don't know how many thousands of times I've heard, you know, guys of his era say, how dare you leave my art? How dare you leave me, you traitor?
Exactly.
Yeah, because they want to pursue their knowledge and their other interests, they're what, disloyal?
Yeah.
You know, because you want to study something? Come on, wake up, you know?
Yeah, go figure. Wow, where did 2 hours go, everybody?
I know.
It's so wild. But thank you so much for joining us today on the Dynamic Dojo radio show.
Yes, thank you, Ed.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
And thank you also for I think you were on Modern Combat Masters earlier this week, right? I think.
Was that what I was on?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because I co-host for that, but I couldn't do it because I didn't have a computer.
I've had like about nine
exactly.
things I've done this week, and I kind of forget which one I've done.
Exactly.
I guess that's my old age. Sorry.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Ron.
You guys are great hosts. You have a great show. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I look forward to our paths crossing in the future.
Yes, for sure. For sure. Well, thank you again for joining us, and thanks for calling in and staying on with us, Master Chappelle.
I absolutely had a ball.
It was like a big party, like a big Ohana party. It was great.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was awesome. So, listeners, join us next week as we have Filipino martial arts dignitary Renee Latosa joining us. Did I get that right, Bob? It's Renee Latosa next week, right?
Yes,
I lost a day during this Philippines trip. I'm still so tripping. What's today? It's Monday. I don't know. All right. Thanks for joining us, listeners. And we'll see you next week. We'll talk to everybody next time. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.